times.
The point does not work, so in order for me to flash sit down right here, so we get over the sitting is okay, right? But the point of the show on the screen, so this is ketosis and hypofluoric state. They're cut together because they're related disorders, conditions, and can see usually a combination of the two. And many patients are usually discussed together and not really clearly to both patients. Vomiting, polyuria, polydipsia, weakness, anorexia, abdominal pain, visual disturbances. So, We don't really know why patients with acute rapid decompensation have abdominal pain. They often present with abdominal pain without any necessary any pathology there that you can find. But that makes it difficult because you're going to have to look for pathology. Visual disturbances, what are they due to? What's the cause of visual disturbance? Changes in the lens, swelling of the lens because of uptake of glucose conversion to fructose, you can't come back out, so you pull the water and get. You can also, of course, have macular edema. But the most common cause would be swelling of the lens. And some of the lens in more advanced cases, even coma, of course. Presenting signs like thyroid hypertension, dehydration, hypothermia. Interesting, hypothermia is quite common in uncontrolled diabetes, and therefore it makes it difficult to detect whether or not they have an infection or not. So we assume in all patients that most likely they do, and often give antibiotics, even if we don't have clear-cut evidence. And in doubt, of course, you need to do culture, usual fever workup, even without fever. The key thing is to get a mass of the temperature, fever, in the hyperosmolar state as well. The skin tends to be warm because of vascular dilatation. They have a specific form of hyperventilation, small respiration. It's different from hypoxic hyperventilation. People with hypoxia, you experience yourself when you go on a jog or whatever, you have tachypnea, right? Breathe rapidly. Crismal respiration is different. There's a different regulation to acidosis in the respiratory center, which results in increased tidal volume, deep inhalation expiration. And this is not often, it's often overlooked by beginning clinicians. There is a profession that looks at respiratory distress. But then you look at abdomen, and it keeps going up. Down. Much more extensive than a normal person. So, there's the look for crismal respiration, because it's not that obvious. Lethargy or coma is pretty obvious. Fruity odor is due to what? Huh? Which one? Acetone. Is acetone a ketone body? No. It's a breakdown product of a ketone body. We'll come to the ketone body. This just shows you a very old paper, 1948, the respiratory adaptation to a change in pH. So you have an increase in the respiratory volume, in the volume here. But then when you go to very low pH, you have an inhibition of respiration. This is also very good. Typically, a patient comes in with uncontrolled diabetes or, you know, hyperosmolar state versus A. There is typically a precipitating factor. And it can be any stress, essentially. Any major stress or acute illness can precipitate the decompensation of diabetes. Infectious conditions listed here, I won't go through all of them, except maybe mention that one specific infection that you only see associated with ketoacidosis is called mucormycosis. And we have to look for that in the DKA because it's a potentially life-threatening condition. It can involve the nasal terminus and spread to the brain. Most, even severe emotional stress can cause decompensation of diabetes. Trauma, pancreatitis, MI, strokes, obviously. Some endocrine conditions. Not infrequently, you see it, especially in young patients, that there's omission of insulin. Sometimes adolescents do it to attract attention. They come back and forth with admission for DKA because they have the need to get attention or whatever. certain drugs can cause the compensation of diabetes, resulting in these states, particularly psychotropic drugs that we see. The mechanism is not very well known. Perhaps it's just because they cause weight gain and they get worsening of insulin resistance and so on. The mechanism is not completely understood, but they can, particularly in patients who have previously known of diabetes, they put on psych medication and a few months later they end up with uncontrolled diabetes in the hospital. We all know about steroids, immunosuppressants, beta blockers. These are being associated, what their role is as really triggers is not so clear. Except for diazoxide, which we only really treat, use for treatment of patients with synovas, so you'll never see it. Diazoxide directly inhibits insulin secretion, so that can, of course, cause decompensation of diabetes. So let's go a little bit over the pathogenesis of these conditions. So in type 1 diabetes, you have absolute insulin deficiency because you have, after a certain number of years, usually in a young patient, it takes probably 5 years to lose all the beta cells. Whereas in type 2 diabetes, you have relative insulin deficiency. Even though they have plenty of insulin, they don't have enough insulin to overcome the insulin resistance that they have. So the unifying concept for diabetes is always insulin deficiency, right? But in type 2 it's relative, in type 1 it's essentially absolute. And that makes a big difference in terms of what happens when you get major stresses, precipitating factors, that raise these counter-regulatory hormones. The critical one being glucagon, but in addition you have catecholamines, cortisol, growth hormone. All these go up with stress. And these hormones are the principal ones that cause the decompensation of the diabetic condition. So then if you don't have, if you still have some insulin around, you don't typically get ketoacidosis because a little bit of insulin will inhibit lipolysis sufficiently so you don't get enough substrate to the liver for making ketone bodies. Typically, a type 2 would decompensate, gets the hypoglycemic state, but not ketoacidosis. Although sometimes you can get ketoacidosis if insulin secretion is also inhibited by glucose toxicity. I'll come back to that. So, just to make a point, ketoacidosis doesn't mean that the patient necessarily has type 1 diabetes. You can sometimes see it in type 2 diabetes. Right? Typically, you see it in type 1 diabetes where you have no insulin around, they don't take the insulin, or have major stress. Then, because of the lack of insulin, you have increased lipolysis, release of free fatty acids, and they go to the liver and get converted to ketone bodies, and body production exceeds the amount that the kidney can secrete, and you get ketoacidosis. So ketones by themselves do not make ketoacidosis. You starve, you're going to have ketones in your urine, and even ketones in your plasma often prolong starvation. As long as you don't have an anion gap, you don't have ketoacidosis. So don't equate positive ketones with serum or with ketoacidosis. Ketoacidosis is a metabolic acidosis due to excess ketones. Okay? Sounds like semantics, but it's actually not. Because I look at in the ICU, they measure ketones in blood mass every day and think it makes a difference. It makes absolutely no difference. You need them only on admission to know that you have ketoacidosis. Afterwards, you don't have an IGAN. Metabolic acidosis. Alright? Anyhow, a little bit more about pathogenesis. So the counter-regulatory hormones, they do several things. They stimulate proteolysis, and they stimulate glycogen breakdown, glycogenolysis. And if you have just these two, then you're going to get hyperosmolality by increased glucose production from gluconeogenesis and from glycogenolysis. Then you get glycosuria, lots of water and electrolytes, dehydration, decreased GFR, becomes a vicious cycle and become hyperosmolar and eventually severely hyperosmolar. If you have no insulin, then you also have increased ketone body formation, and in addition to the hyperosmolarity, you get the ketoacidosis. Right? Typically it's a combination. Ketoacidosis is not separate because these things are also going on in ketoacidosis. So most patients with ketoacidosis are also hyperosmolar. But the ones with hyperosmolar syndrome are more extremely hyperosmolar and less typically don't have ketoacidosis. But they're overlapping conditions. A little bit about the biochemistry very briefly. The main cause regulatory hormone is glucagon, what it does primarily in the liver cell. It promotes glycogen breakdown and it promotes gluconeogenesis, right? Alanine being the major precursor, this one. So this comes from fat and this comes from protein breakdown. The ketone bodies are derived from fatty acids coming from the fat cells, increased lipolysis. They enter the liver cell, and if insulin is low, then they can enter mitochondria. Because CPT1 is not suppressed. So they go into the mitochondria, and I don't have to go through the extent of biochemistry, that's not the point of the lecture. The point is, they enter the mitochondria, and in the mitochondria, ketone bodies are formed. And the ketone bodies are ketoacetate and hydroxybutyrate. Acetone is a spontaneous breakdown product of ketoacetate. Acetone it's not an acid, so it's not a ketone body. It doesn't play any role in the degree of ketoacidosis you have. It's a breakdown product and helps us sometimes to detect the patient by the smell of fruity odor of the patient. And the urine, of course, is high in human indication, making it better. So what's the problem here? That there are two ketone bodies, and we measure only one of them. Which one do we measure with the acid test tablets? Only measures acetoacetate and acetone. It does not measure the hydroxybutyrate. Normally, the ratio of hydroxybutyrate to acetoacetate is about 2 to 1, but in patients that have also some hypoxia and so on, there can be a major shift. Because this is an NADH, maybe dependent. It's a change between those two ketone bodies. You have a major shift to beta-hydroxybutyrate, and the patient has minimal ketone elevation and has severe ketoacidosis. But this is not measured routinely by us. It can be measured, but it's an expensive test, and therefore it's not routinely done. It's not necessary because there's always some elevation of ketones. You just have to be aware of that the degree of ketones, the dilution in serum, how many degrees you dilute and still get positive acid testing, may underestimate the degree of ketoacidosis initially because most of it may be beta-hydroxybutyrate, that's not measured. And as the patient gets better, it gets shifted back and the acetone gets worse, you think the patient's getting worse. It's not getting worse, it's getting better. Almost the anion gap closed, right? That's which ketone body you have doesn't make much difference, except for the assessment makes a difference. If you have any questions, speak up. Anytime, please. So, what are the catabolic cascades in the liver induced by the counter-regulatory hormones, principally glucagon, is enhanced glycogen breakdown, enhanced gluconeogenesis, and enhanced ketone body formation. So the acids, literally increased fatty acids, is a major driver of ketone body formation, and then in the absence, with the presence of glucagon, you have stimulation of ketone body formation in addition to this. CPT1 is high because it's not inhibited by malonuclease, which gets induced by its So then when Asatirkoi Kaboksi goes up and shifts rays of Mazirkoi, then you turn off one three fatty acids can no longer enter. I'm getting problems in my hands here. So in absence of interest they can enter, and that's why you need to know information. Our bodies are not all bad. They cause acidosis. But they actually can be used as fuel in muscle and in colored muscle and skeletal muscle can use beta-hydroxybutyrate and acetoacetate and convert them to acetic anions and burn them in the citric acid cycle. So the problem is that the kidney, even though it has an excellent ability to excrete ketone bodies, if your GFR drops because of hyperosmolality and loss of fluids with electrolytes, then you have buildup of ketones, and then you get ketosis. So I want to briefly mention the concept of glucotoxicity. Lipotoxicity also plays a role, but I don't want to primarily talk about glucotoxicity because it's just a little bit confusing to most people. When glucose goes up, you have hyperglycemia. It lasts for a few weeks. You get what's called a reversible glucose toxicity. The hyperglycemia, moderately chronic hyperglycemia, inhibits the ability of insulin to stimulate glucose uptake in cells. And view this as a protective mechanism, that the cells protect themselves against being killed by getting too much glucose. At the expense of the extracellular milieu, because the glucose builds up in the extracellular fluid. But the cells are protected by the fact that not all the glucose goes into the cells. That kills. So this is a reversal inhibition of insulin action. And in fact, there's also an addition eventually of insulin secretion by chronic hyperglycemia. That's why you sometimes see particularly young people with no onset diabetes that are totally unaware of it and go on for a few weeks with hyperglycemia, keep on drinking fruit juices and sodas and come in with a glucose of 1,000 and or higher. And eventually may or may not go into coma, but they eventually may have inhibition of insulin secretion to the point by the time they present they have mild ketoacidosis. This is the so-called Flatbush diabetes, first described at South State. Flatbush Avenue went by there, and described it, thought that the kind of patient that they see typically blacks from the West Indies, they thought it was a specific disease for this population of diabetics, and they called it Flatbush diabetes. Those are the kind of patients they see a lot of. Turns out ultimately that can be seen in any ethnic group, any race or ethnic group. It's basically a phenomenon due to glucose toxicity that can sometimes, in type 2 diabetes, be inhibition of insulin secretion to the point that they get here. Okay? If you have prolonged hypoglycemia, then you can get actually loss of beta cells because acidosis of it. And this is one of the reasons that promotes progression of diabetes. Poorly controlled diabetics have this glucose toxicity as one of the causes of their progressive loss of beta cells. Okay, enough said about this, so let's go back clinically now, essentially what I said to point here. When the patient comes in, it's essential to rule the section. That goes pretty much without saying, and I think these things are pretty obvious to all of you. Basically, you do a workup to make sure the patient doesn't have an infection that needs treatment. we assess the degree of hyperosmolality by measuring their light, so their electrolyte profile, and then you all know about the calculation, 2 times sodium plus glucose plus BUN over 2.8. Glucose over 18, BUN over 2.8. Where do these numbers come from? The molecular weight of glucose is 180. Therefore, if you express in milligram per deciliter, it's 18, right? That's why it's 18. And BUN is a molecular weight of 28. It's expressed in milligram per deciliter, so it's divided by 2.8. Because sodium and these are milli equivalents, so get it all the same. Alright? So you measure and calculate. So you calculate it from the measured electrolyte profile, and then you send it to the lab. And if there's an order of molar gap, that means that you have unaccounted for osmoles, which could be ketone body. What else could it be? Phosphate? No. Typically not. You don't have to agree. Because you measure. Ketone body could be alcohol, ethylene glycol, those kind of things. So that's why you want to know if there's not a smaller gap. Then you want to know what CO smaller gap due to. Right? That's key. We also look at, so this is to determine whether we have a smaller gap or not, that's important. And then there's a detective serum osmolarity which just takes 2 times sodium plus glucose over 18, and if it's greater than 320, then we call it hyperosmolar state. Right? So the more severe. Why do we don't include BUN in here? It's because urea can freely cross membranes. Urea doesn't contribute to the effective osmolarity. Or contribute to the measured osmolarity. So if you were to look for an anion gap, you have to include it. You know what is the degree of osmolar activity in the cell that pulls water out of cells, and you look at the effective osmolarity. You correct the sodium because when glucose goes up, it pulls water out of cells and lower sodium. So we need to correct how much is accounted for by that effect rather than by dehydration. So if the patient has a very high glucose and normal sodium, then they're severely dehydrated because sodium should be much lower. So we want to correct the sodium and see what the actual sodium, correct sodium is. That tells you how severely dehydrated the patient is. In addition to having, knows whatever. Then, of course, the anion gap is key to determine metabolic acidosis. This is from old studies, but just some rough ideas. What are the kind of numbers that you see when you try to divide these two syndromes in patients who have more typical DKA or more typical hyperosmolar state? What are the kind of numbers that are seen? That this hasn't really changed very much. So what are the differences? In hyperosmolar state, they come in with higher sodium than in DKA. Why? Because when you have ketoacidosis, you get sick from acidosis. You start vomiting, nauseous. You come in earlier than if you have hyperosmolar state. So if you have a very high sodium, very high glucose, eventually come in, but it takes longer to come to the hospital because hyperosmolality causes polyuria, of course, but drink or food can get by quite some time. Whereas the ketoacidosis get very sick quickly because of the acidosis. So therefore, the sodium is lower, is higher here because of more severe dehydration. Potassium tends to be elevated in DKA at the beginning or versus hyperosmolar state, more typically. It's key here to already stress that total body potassium is severely depleted in both instances. Yet they come in typically with a normal or sometimes even elevated potassium. give them big baths, not a big problem. As soon as you give them fluids, treatment, injection, drugs, so you need to anticipate them and give them. Typically on admission they don't have hypokalemia. The bicarb of course is lower in PKA, the PKA of course is lower. PCO2 is lower because you have more respiratory compensation attempt in DKA. Of course you have more time gap and you have more greater increased effectiveness from a lot of the hypersmolar state. And therefore more dehydration increases, creatinine, ketones can be positive in both, and they're just higher in patients with typically. Bread and butter stuff that you all know and just briefly review, okay? Typical water electrolyte losses, people are not typically aware of how much patients are depleted. Total body depletion. Patients can typically patient with DKA is 6 liters now. Hyperosmolar state as much as 9 liters now. Please take severely back. This is important because most house staff are reluctant to give high levels of fluid to them. We give them very fast, severely hypersmolar patients. You worry about, you know, these old babies with CHF and going into pulmonary edema, which of course should be a concern. So these are the deficits of sodium chloride, potassium. You can see that potassium 3 to 12 milliequivalents per kilogram deficit in DKA. So there's always deficit. There's some deficit in phosphate, magnesium, and calcium. That gets repeated with the patient without eating anyway, so it's not clinically that important. Poor prognostic indicators. Obvious. Older patients, more severely acidotic. Hypotensive when they come in, marked hyposmolarity, high BUN, so reflection of that, and if they have associated diseases like MRI and stroke, treatment considerations. So, precipitating cause is evident in 80%, so you should look for it, and if it's a treatable cause, you should obviously treat it. We went over those. EKG basically in all patients, because in diabetics you can have silent MI. We're aware of that, right? Isotonic sodium is initially preferred. You want to first expand intravascular volume and then deal with the rest of dehydration. Since the patient loses primarily glucose and water, they lose more water than sodium. So ultimately they need free water more than safe. But you start out with isotonic saline to extend the intravascular volume. Once you have stable hemodynamic parameters, then you can switch to hypotonic fluids. IV insulin is the preferred mode of administration. People have done comparisons with subcutaneous intramuscular IV and so on, continuous infusion. We all put these people on a drip, so it's not a big issue. But just to remember, subcutaneous insulin is not a good idea because it can stay there, the patient who is in shock, and it doesn't get absorbed, and that you're giving lots of insulin just sitting in the subcutaneous. So nobody should. Initially, intramuscular works just as well as intravenous, but IV drip, of course, it's much easier to adjust to the preferred mode. Of course, it requires more supervision. If you don't have the supervision, we used to treat people with DKA when I was a house staff years ago on the wards. So once an hour, give them IV injection of insulin. Check their labs, give them IM injection of insulin. Once of IM or IV. Insulin has a half-life of 3 to 5 minutes. It binds to the receptors. If you give a big dose of insulin, it binds to the receptor and saturates insulin receptors, and the action lasts for about an hour of a single injection of insulin. But of course it's more convenient to have the drip going. but it needs to be monitored, of course. Potassium depletion is present in all patients, that's key. And prevention, of course, long-term goal, bicarb administration rarely indicated. We'll go into this a little bit more. Other considerations, you type in cross mass, as a patient is anemic, or any consideration of potential needing of blood transfusion, blood cultures have indicated aspirate gastric contents. This is important. In DKA particular, patients often have gastric atony and distension of the stomach. They may have full stomach. They pass it out and then put out an NG treatment. They are at risk for aspiration. They are supine and not with it, and then all of a sudden they aspirate, and then you will have another problem. They are tense. So if you recognize that before, put an NG tube down and decompress the stomach. Catheterized if needed, of course, you want to monitor output. Most of the time, when a patient is unconscious, you will certainly catheterize. Give oxygen as indicated, keep patient in view. Those two components of IV fluids, insulin, potassium. In those, in that order, not insulin first. If you give insulin alone to a patient with hyperosmolar state, you can kill them. Why? They're already quite contracted, dehydrated. You give them insulin, the glucose goes into cells and water follows with it, and they become more thicker with the shock. Right? So you don't want to give insulin by itself, you want to give fluids. That's a key thing. Fluids, large amounts, small tolerance. Insulin, of course, then in addition to the fluids, and potassium is always needed. So, patient comes in DKA often if they have hyperkalemia. At that stage you don't get potassium. But you add it to the fluids as soon as the potassium is normal to prevent them from going into hypoxia. IV fluids. First 3 hours, 2 to 3 liters. 2 to 3 liters. The first hour you should give 5 liters. Pour it in. Patient are severely dehydrated. Subsequently, they switch to half normal saline with about 150-300 ml per hour. Yet. And then the other key thing is we don't want to normalize the glucose immediately. New house staff tend to think, okay, the quicker I normalize the patient, the better I am. So the problem is, if you lower the osmolality too quickly, you can get this is a little bit because the brain has a fluid that can't get rid of so quickly, and you can't get swelling of the brain and herniation and kill the patient. Mostly seen in children, fortunately, but it can be easily seen in adults. So you want to bring the blood sugar to 200 to 250, keep it there. So once it comes down to 250, you hang up, you add glucose to the fluid, so that you maintain, keep giving insulin to close the anion gap. But you add, give glucose to maintain the sugar for the next 24 hours, not lower than 200 to 250. Okay, that's key. So insulin is given roughly about 10 units per hour in the infusion. The rate has to be increased if you don't have a good response by 4 hours. And you decrease it when the acidosis is corrected. So the insulin drip gets adjusted. Some patients have more insulin resistance than others, and so you can't just give a fixed dose to see what happens. So how quickly does the glucose fall? If you have a glucose that is greater than 600, then even if it's 1,000 or 1,500, I've seen people with up to 2,000, almost like syrup. When you give fluids, the glucose falls very rapidly because what happens, you increase GFR. And once the GFR is normalized, you can rapidly lose a lot of the glucose. It goes down to about 600. And you can't get said to you, glucose over 300 if you have a normal GFR. You can take as much sugar containing fluids. And glucose just excreted in the urine if you have a normal kidney function. Or when you get dehydrated, so the first four glucose primarily due to improved kidney function. And then the rate of fall that you should have with insulin is roughly about 100 milligrams per deciliter per hour. Fall. When it reaches 600, 700, 600. From then on, it should fall by about 100 milligrams per deciliter per hour if your insulin, if your receptors are saturated, if the insulin is working. If you don't see that fall, then you increase the rate. Alright? And the key thing at the end is that you don't stop the drip and say, okay, send the patient to the wall. And they can heal from then on. So you can take care of the diabetes. If you stop the drip, what happens? 2 to 4 minutes, it's gone. And if the patient gets transferred down to the floor by the time he arrives at the floor, he has relapse of ketosis more quickly. So never stop the drip before giving an hour or two before you give subcutaneous insulin, so that they have immediate acting insulin that starts kicking in when the drip is turned off. Alright? Then on the floor they can deal with further management of the diabetes. But never stop the drip without having immediate insulin on board already. Potassium. So when the plasma potassium is less than 6, the recommendation is that as long as EKG is normal and urine flow is documented, then they already recommend to give potassium, even if the potassium is still elevated but it's less than 6. Usually we wait till it's normal, but those are the recommendations. And rarely people don't dare to put 80 milligrams into a bottle. But the recommendation is to give 40 to 80 milligrams per hour of potassium when it drops below 3.5. Because these patients are markedly potassium depleted. If you give lots of fluids, you have to give potassium. Most of the time the nurses won't even allow you to eat. But 40 you can. So you monitor mental sort of vital signs, body weight, that's all. Now with the meds that we have, I think it's not so difficult. But this is a good indicator of how much fluid you're gaining, if the patient's gaining weight, as it should. Right? This is indicated. Laboratory parameters, but the obvious, but key thing is you want to make sure that you know what the rate of fall of glucose is, and that you don't get hypokalemia, and that your ion gap is closing gradually. So you monitor these things at normal rates, more or less. You check also this. Now the phosphate magnesium, if magnesium deficiency is present, you should give magnesium. Phosphate, people have shown it makes no difference. Although all those patients are hypophosphatemic, you give them lots of fluid without phosphate, phosphate goes low. Nobody has shown it makes a difference whether or not you give potassium phosphate to these patients in terms of the outcome. But also you give potassium chloride, potassium phosphate. So you give it a little bit. Makes no documented difference. Nobody has ever shown that. Because once you ketones, they say, yeah, every 2 hours, you're on ketones. I would say it's not really important. What you look at is the anion gap. But as long as the patient has ketones, that means ketones are not completely cleared out of the system. So ideally, the patient should be in the unit with an IV drip until they have no more ketones in their urine. I don't think that's really being adhered to. Because they need beds, so they kick them out as soon as the anion gap is closed. But ketones are completely resolved until the ketones are all excreted. You monitor fluid intake, output, insulin. This is all pretty obvious. when you give insulin, then you get reversal of the process by building up glycogen from glucose, and by using glucose in glycolysis and entering a citric acid cycle, and so on. So the biochemical mechanisms, you know, I won't go into two and one. But we just summarize here what happens in the liver. Now we have an anabolic acid, in contrast to the catabolic acid. The absence of insulin is counter-regulatory hormones. Now when insulin is increased, it goes up by exogenous administration in this case, then you form glycogen and you use glucose in glycolysis. You form acetyl-CoA. Now the fatty acids, number one, much fewer fatty acids come from the fat cells because you have inhibited glycolysis. So you don't have a substrate for ketone body formation. In addition, the fatty acids can't get into the mitochondria because an insulin is high, acetyl-CoA gets converted to malonyl-CoA by acetyl-CoA carboxylase, and malonyl-CoA inhibits CPT1, which is the major cofactor that allows fatty acids, acetyl-CoA, to get into mitochondria. Therefore, the fatty acids are converted to triglycerides and no longer to ketone bodies. What are the major adverse effects of severe acidosis? Check my time here so I don't. It's 1:15. Okay. If you have severe acidosis, that's going to have a significant adverse effects, inhibiting cardiac contraction. Get vasodilation because you don't respond to vasoconstrictors like catecholamines and angiotensin II. And as I showed you in the curve, you get inhibition of respiration when you get to severe acidosis. So you lose the ability to compensate flowing of CO2 by hyperventilation. So what are the potential adverse effects of giving bicarb to patients? Even though they have ketoacidosis, most of the time we don't give bicarb. Because bicarbonate will drive cells into potassium into cells and cause worsening of hypokalemia. That's a major concern. And there's a concern of, that's mostly theoretical, I'm not sure how well documented it is, that there may be decreased oxygen delivery in the periphery because of the dissociation curve from hemoglobin. But it's mostly theoretical. But we don't like to give potassium bicarbonate unless the patient is very severe. Because the primary is the risk of hypokalemia. So what are the indications? The pH is less than 7. Bicarb less than 5, pH potassium greater than 6.5. If you have hypotension, that's refractory to pressors and fluids, primarily refractory to fluids. Patients should recover. If they come in with low blood pressure and you give them fluids, they should, if their blood pressure is low, then maybe they have acidosis to the extent that they can't respond to the pressors. And therefore have vasodilatation. That may be an indication. Or a severely impaired left ventricular function, respiratory depression. Everybody gets a late hyperkalemic acidosis. If you give saline, which we primarily do, we don't give physiologic fluids, but we give saline. And so we give lots of chloride. So all the patients get hyperkalemia in the course of the treatment. It doesn't cause any major problem, but sometimes they get marked hypochloremic acidosis. That may be an indication to give bicarb. Or if they have associated lactic acidosis. Complication of therapy, hypoglycemia obviously should be avoided. Hypokalemia or hyperkalemia, depending on not giving enough potassium, giving too much or at the wrong time. Fluid overload, course, inflation with limited cardiac function and so on, those are concerns. Hyperchloremic acidosis can be seen, and cerebral edema I talked about by too quickly lowering the glucose. ARDS can be sometimes seen, and there is abnormalities in coagulation profiles you can get from thrombotic episodes in patients. The main goal should be mentioned by educating the patient how to deal with stress and infections and problems. That's all I have. So, questions? Correction of hypophosphatemia. It has been raised as a concern, but people have done studies where they gave phosphate and not compared it versus not giving phosphate, and the clinical cases. So it's a more theoretical concern than a clinically important concern. So then, now, I think it's a good idea to give a little phosphate by alternate potassium and this is which is potassium chloride. But clearly, the clinical data that are out there, to my knowledge, do not show evidence that it makes a difference whether or not to give phosphate. Your points are well taken. Okay, any other questions? Hypotonic fluid, you will eventually correct the sodium. I mean, you will correct it. Pardon me? There's nothing wrong with doing that. Nobody does it. The surgeons use that primarily, right? It probably makes sense to do it. But for some reason medical people get that in because I think it is sure that would make a difference. Yeah.
Well, you said that you'll measure the hydroxyurea, you'll measure
the ratio. Is there a way to correct for the ratio if you know that you're positive? Difficult to predict. No, you'd have to measure directly. In fact, Dr. Fulop has done studies on this in the past, and he measured it. But it turns out that clinically, if you assess the patient correctly, treat him correctly, that additional information is not going to have a significant benefit in your patient. It's not routinely measured. You should just be aware of that you may have underestimated by just measuring fluoroacetate. If you're aware of that, then you will not be surprised that all of a sudden you get worsening of ketones that are measured every day, which is totally unnecessary. In my opinion, you measure ketones, well, the urine ketones may be useful to know how long it takes to get rid of all the ketones, but the plasma ketones are initially just to see that you can account for the degree of metabolic acidosis by your ketones, by ketones. For example, if you have very low ketones in the plasma, you have to immediately think about maybe, I'm looking, you have maybe acid glycol poisoning or you have lactic acidosis, something else is going on. So we cannot just assume that because somebody is diabetic and has an anion gap because they have ketoacidosis. So that's why they measure initially the ketones, and if they're appropriately elevated, that's settle the issue. There's only issues every day when you get to people. It's not going to change your management. Then you use the other again. But, so that's the recipe, okay? Yeah. Keep in mind as long as the patient is hyper-retrieving for aggressive sodium, that tells you that you're still significantly dehydrated, that you're not getting enough fluid, basically. So it's a good way. You should definitely look at that, not just at the other idea.
And does the rate of correction
include? I don't know if there's a, there's a rate of correction that is should be watch. I don't know. Yeah, I think that sounds like reasonable, like in any form of dehydration, that's not very different in this condition. Any other questions? If not, class is dismissed. Thank you.